Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. I am, of course, one part of a fairly dubious and uncelebrated double act. With me is Thea Lenarduzzi, eater of cheese, exuberant pronouncer of foreign words and fancier of dogs.
Who's the straight one in this? It's me, isn't it?
I don't know, really. I think as we're going to hear it from Charlie Higson and his
piece, do not qualify.
You don't know. I don't think that's the point. It's old-fashioned to think one's
yeah,
straight.
Yeah. Well, so one. I think what he says in his piece is that one person's job to kind of try to keep the show on the road and
give structure,
and impose some order, and the other one just sabotages.
And it's very hard to know who's sabotaging whom here. I don't think we should name names.
Mutual sabotage.
Yeah. Dog update. Alf.
Alf. Yep. It is Alf.
It is Alf. And when's he arriving?
He's not here yet.
He
will be a matter of days.
A matter of days.
The tension is building.
And are you taking time off to look after him?
Of course I am. Well, I'll be working from home.
Oh dear. Is that
I'll be running around the fields with a dog and then checking my emails every now and again.
I think having a new dog and working in inverted commas from home.
Let's face it, I'm going to be trying to stop him from eating and weeing on everything.
That's exactly right. So you're not here next week for that reason?
I'm not, no.
Even though you're working from home?
Technically,
you should call in to do this podcast from home if you're working.
I can pass you over to Alf.
Yeah. We might
see
even
if he's
try
a
and
vocal dog or not. We don't know. I don't know if he barks.
Tell you what, we should do this. I'm looking quizzically at Matt here. Can we have a 2-minute just call in to check how Alf's doing and actually get Alf on the line?
This is Alf calling.
Yeah. All right. I tell you what. This time next week, when Thea is as you're supposed, because I wouldn't like to intrude upon a holiday, but as you're working from home, we'll call you, Thea. Okay, we're going to do that. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. Google TLS subscriptions and get the best deal this week. Coming up on the show, yes, my rather laboured reference to double acts had a point. We'll be talking about their role and status in comedy with someone who has experience of it, Charlie Higson, the writer and comedian. He'll be in the studio, as will Margaret Drabble, who's been reading some new releases from the estate of Anthony Burgess, the man who Philip Larkin once called the Batman of contemporary letters. So ubiquitous was his work. We have more of his heroic output to talk about today. Comedy and double acts go together like, well, make your own joke there. But the genre is full of them. The two Ronnies, Laurel and Hardy, French and Saunders, Morecambe and Wise, Fry and Laurie, and so on and so on. This year we've seen Laurel and Hardy return to the big screen as played by Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly at the end of their careers, struggling with the baggage of their fame and friendship. There's also been books about Morecambe and Wise, Fry and Laurie, and the history of comedy double acts more generally. And we got to examine them. A fine comic writer, once described, I see lazily from Wikipedia, as the missing link between Dick Emery and Bret Easton Ellis, which is faintly terrifying, who is himself part of a very successful writing partnership, Charlie Higson. He joins Thea and me in the studio. Charlie, hello.
Hello there.
That is quite a Dick Emery and Bret Easton Ellis.
Yeah, I think that was when I wrote some sort of adult thrillers in the early 90s, which were quite extreme, sort of dealing with psychopaths, which is where the Bret Easton Ellis thing.
Yeah.
And because I was writing for Harry Enfield at the time, Dick Emery sort of made sense.
Yeah. They're not the worst things to be put together.
No,
that's
an enduring quote, and I think it's quite a good one.
Yeah, you can live with it. Before we talk about writing, I think we might talk about on-screen partnerships. And Laurel and Hardy's the big movie, Coogan and Reilly. What did you learn from that? Were you familiar? Were you one of these sort of aficionados of Laurel and Hardy before?
Well, I mean, you know, I've grown up with them. I mean, you know, they were always on the TV when I was a kid. You know, they'd put them on at sort of kids' tea time viewing slot. So they were always there, and I've always loved them. And I knew a bit about the end, about, you know, how sad it was, and, you know, how Stan Laurel was the driving force behind it and couldn't let it go. And after Oliver Hardy died, which happened, I think, quite soon after the events in the film, you know, Stan Laurel carried on writing. And I did know a bit about the tour, which actually I think went a lot worse than it's depicted in in the film. I've read a few accounts of people at the time going to see it and saying it was a bit sad. They were very old and they couldn't really do it anymore, but it was nice to see them. Whereas in the film, as you have to, they sort of triumph. They win over small audiences get bigger and bigger and sort of get back on top.
And then there's Morecambe and Wise. I mean, the two central double acts, I think, in your piece are Morecambe and Wise and Laurel and Hardy. Do you think they're similar? Because there's a kind of a driving force. One of them was more of a driving force than the other. They sort of struggled on a bit, didn't they, as well?
Yeah, I mean, there was the whole thing with Morecambe and Wise at the end of the 70s, when they were at their absolute peak. They got poached by ITV. Oh. And the idea was, apparently, I mean, obviously they were offered a lot more money, as we know, the BBC can never afford to actually pay anyone properly, despite what everyone thinks.
Yeah.
But the big carrot was that ITV was saying they would make a big film for them. And, you know, that was particularly Ernie Wise's thing, as he always wanted to break into Hollywood. You know, he would have loved to have been Laurel and Hardy. But they were at their peak, and which means that they were actually coming down the other side. And the thought of them at that age actually pulling off making a movie, it just doesn't make sense. They were sort of inspired by, and this is covered quite well in Gary Morecambe's book about them, Eric's son, that they were sort of inspired by the success of the Pink Panther films. And they thought, well, Peter Sellers is older than us. He's having a lot of international success making comedy. And as Gary Morecambe says, you know, there was as much chance really of them breaking into cinema like Peter Sellers as there was of Peter Sellers making a big primetime sketch show for the TV.
But they thought it was an equivalence. They thought that...
you know, if he can do it, you know, we can do it. We're funny. But I think it's quite hard to do a double act like that in a film, because it's all so based about the interaction with the audience.
Were they funny? I mean, it comes to me because I'm...
Were they funny? What kind of a question is that?
They kind of have... you're going to punch me in the face when I say this, but they kind of come to me with a sort of patina of naffness, Morecambe and Wise. When I think of them, I kind of think... Christmas specials. I can't think of laughing. I think my dad.
Well, I, you know, for me, Eric Morecambe is very funny. I think what they actually did quite well was that Ernie Wise sort of encapsulated naffness. That was his thing. He was this little guy who wanted to be a song and dance man and break into Hollywood and get his plays formed. And we knew it was all vanity, and actually he was hopeless. And Eric knew that, but Eric was very loyal to him, and that gave space for Eric to sort of be, to dance around that. And you know, I think he did some stuff. Physically, he was enormously good. Like Laurel and Hardy, he moved beautifully. You know, all four of them were great dancers and had grown up in that sort of variety music hall tradition of doing a bit of everything.
And Morecambe and Wise, this was a bit of a revelation to me. I didn't realise that in their peak time, they didn't really write. They didn't really write their material. It was
they
one
never
man.
Wrote. No, they never they, wrote any
so
of their stuff.
So they never wrote any of it.
No, no. Oh. Well, that being said, I don't know what they did when they were originally.
Yeah, I mean, they must have started
treading the
kind
boards.
Of,
yeah. I think they were using sort of traditional routines and things. But certainly, once they moved to TV successfully on ITV in the 60s, they had this double act writing partnership of Hills and Green, who wrote all their shows for about 10 years. It was. I think Eddie Braben actually prevented them from being. If they'd carried on with Hills and Green, they would have just been naff, and they probably would have been forgotten. But Eddie Braben did modernise them and make them more interesting.
And did he introduce, because it kind of thinks this sort of pathos that you bring. This sense of failure is part of the act, and so it's not just laughter. There's something more sophisticated going on there.
Yes, and I think that's what Eddie Braben brought out so well was the he made it a relationship, you know. It wasn't a real relationship. That wasn't how they were in real life, but it worked as a TV relationship, and he gave them depth. And that was always the great thing about Laurel and Hardy. You know, you did feel that they lived in their world.
But they didn't. They weren't. And you say that both of them, they wouldn't go out for
they,
the drinks together.
They were very different types. Oliver Hardy liked living the high life, gambling, womanising, drinking. And Stan Laurel would stay at home writing the scripts.
You need someone to do that, though.
You do.
Which is we're going to get to, because I find the writing of comedy... We talk a lot about pairs. Like you mentioned Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenet, who did Porridge.
Mm.
Pythons, when you talk to them, there was... I think Eric Idle was on his own, but they split into pairs otherwise, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
And you wrote with Paul Whitehouse for the Fast Show. So what is the dynamic? Do you think comedy needs a person to bounce it off?
I think it does help a huge amount. I mean, you know, there have been some great solo writers like Eddie Braben, who did it by himself, although it drove him half nuts. But I certainly find writing comedy, it makes it much easier if you're trying to make someone laugh and someone you respect, and you both try and make each other laugh, and that works, stays in. And you know, I think for any writing partnership to work, it's cliche to say it, but it's like a marriage. You've both got to do something different. You've both got to bring to it what the other person can't.
So how did it work with you and Paul Whitehouse?
I tend to do the sitting at the computer making sense of it all, while he sort of is more freeform, roving around, throwing out ideas and doing funny voices, and I'll think, how can I make that into a sketch or a piece or a character or whatever.
I like your left hand, right hand of a pianist analogy.
So you're the left hand, is that right? Do I know
pianist? You
haven't really properly read the article. Yeah. Yes. It's I say it slightly tongue in cheek because it's a little bit poncy, but yes, the left and right hand of a piano, where the left hand, which is what I mainly do, is you're giving it. Yes, you see, you were right.
Yeah.
Is giving it the structure and the holding down the sort of the harmonic roots of the whole thing and keeping it all together. And the right hand is the one that does all the flourishes that everybody kind of pays attention to. But on its own, the right hand is just, as I said in the article, is just twiddly bits.
Mm.
Is there a sense of competition? I mean, because presumably there's a tension in all double acts as well, which may or may not be creatively full of potential, where if someone is the slightly showier one and the other person is perhaps doing the slightly more effortful side of it, is there a tension that can build up?
I think in any long-term working relationship, inevitably tensions arise, because you're going to get that thing of one of them thinking, actually, I'm the clever one.
Yeah, I can do this
without
myself.
Without me, this wouldn't work. But you do have to keep reminding yourself, actually, you both rely on the other person. But, I mean, a huge number, particularly of writing double acts, have sort of broken up acrimoniously, and then they never talk to each other for years.
Yeah. I was telling Stig just before we came on that a couple of my friends are a comedy duo, Chiara and Roisin. And my friend Chiara basically said that she learned every life skill you could ask for from being in this duo. Compromise, responsibility, humility, all of these things. And she said that's all just from, 5 years of working with the same person day in, day out, and having to explain everything. Something, you would think you wouldn't have to explain a joke, but sometimes you do, and it's only through explaining it that then you can make it work.
Yeah, well, it certainly gives a great strength to your material, because you've tried it out and you've tested it with the other person, and you know where you've analysed where the weaknesses are and you've fixed that. So by the time you present that to someone else, hopefully you've got something that is pretty watertight.
But you've got to be very honest. I mean, presumably if you're working with someone and you say something that you think's funny and Paul turns around to you, that's not funny.
Well, it happens.
Yeah,
you do need to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the characters I did on the Fast Show, a car salesman called Swiss Tony, I only managed to get him on in the third series because Paul kept saying, I don't think he's very funny, I don't think we should do it. And eventually I said, look, I'm just going to do it, OK? And I did, and it was extremely funny.
And extremely successful. And extremely successful. Do you say that? I told you that would work out. When you're in a double act, I've interviewed double acts. They're kind of a nightmare to interview, actually. I'm not a very good interviewer, but the main point is, I think when people are very close, it's quite hard to interview them because they're finishing each other's sentence or laughing at each other.
Yeah, well, they do their shtick.
But do you find yourself falling into a role when you're interviewed with Paul?
Well, I did talk about this a little bit in the article. Is that when we're interviewed, my urge as the left hand is always to kind of explain and say why we did things and how we did things and be quite dry and probably quite boring.
You carry the thing.
Well, I'm trying to, because I think, well, what they probably want is the facts. Whereas Paul's drive is towards entertainment. So he's just trying to make the interviewer laugh, which actually in the end is probably what they want. If you're interviewing a double act, you want a funny article, not a dry history. So that's the closest I've been to in that sort of dynamic of being the straight man trying to make sense of it all, while the other person is just kind of extemporizing around you and trying to rip it all apart.
You say in the piece, though, that that sort of idea of the straight man and the funny man, it doesn't always exist.
No, and I think Lauren Hardy are a classic example of that. That some people say, well, Hardy was the straight man, but he was as funny as Laurel in a very different way.
Yeah.
And so what I talk about really is one of them who's trying to sort of hold things together and the other's trying to pull them apart, I think is a better description of how a double act works, although it's not as snappy as straight man or a funny man.
Fry and Laurie are also in this.
And again, Who's the straight man?
And are they
Fry and Laurie?
And actually, when I think of Fry and Laurie, I think of kind of ensemble. I think of Blackadder, which isn't them. Jeeves and Wooster is more them, but they didn't write it. I mean, are they?
Well, the very first stuff they were doing on TV when they broke through doing Saturday Night Live and Friday Night Live, they very much were a double act on that, and they were really funny on that.
Were they good? Do you remember them coming out?
Oh yeah, totally. Because you know that's the first work I was doing in TV, so watching them at work was fantastic. And then on the back of that, they did their sketch show, which actually ran for quite a few series.
Have you seen it there? It's funny. I mean, I can remember bits of it in a way that
weird that even though that it was on for quite a long time, I think unless you're a real Fry and Laurie aficionado, it's not probably as well known as some of the other sketch shows that were around at the time.
No.
I grew up on Morecambe and Wise in Italy, which is quite weird.
Were they big in Italy?
No, my grandparents used to tape. So they'd arrive with a suitcase full of tapes, and it was mostly Morecambe and Wise and the Antiques Roadshow.
And did you watch them? And what did you think?
I remember loving it, but I'm not... I don't know. I mean, probably most of it I didn't quite get, but I was aware of there being three generations sitting on the sofa or watching the same thing and laughing. So I think it was kind of bound up in the context of that.
I kind of remember my dad watching it and my brother and I thinking it was naff. That's why I kind of have this sort of naffness sense with Morecambe and Wise.
Well, when were you watching it, though?
So this would have
you
been...
See, you look a lot younger than
mid-80s?
Yeah, you see, by the mid-80s they were on ITV and the show wasn't very good.
And it wasn't good.
Well, Eddie Braben wasn't writing it anymore.
Yeah.
Because contractually he was tied to the BBC, so... Yeah. You know, they were at their peak in the 70s, and it was event TV, and yeah, you know, a lot of it was sort of old fashioned sketches. But the really good stuff, which was the two of them, like the stuff on the empty stage, just the two of them, as themselves, two of them in their flat, and those bits were great. But there were traditional sketches which perhaps haven't lasted as well.
Before we get to where are the double acts of today, which is the sort of question you end your piece on, are there any other double acts? Yeah. Well, no, exactly. I want to talk about that. Are there anyone? Who are the other ones we haven't talked about? I mean, if you're double acts that aren't in this piece we haven't mentioned, that you would say are the ones to point to?
Well, one of the books I reviewed is called Double Act, I think.
Yeah, The Double Act.
The Double Act.
A History of British Comedy Duos.
But he sort of slightly arbitrarily has a cut-off point of the sort of end of the 80s. Whereas in actual fact, there were quite a few good British double acts that came to prominence in the 90s, such as Mitchell and Webb, Vic and Bob, who, you know, were probably the most direct descendants of Morecambe and Wise.
Where you kind of felt there was a friendship and there was a hinterland outside the show.
And what they were doing, everybody used to say, well, wow, it's just mad and surreal. But actually what they were doing was a very traditional old-fashioned music called double act. But there were strange bits in it as well. But at the core, if you just sort of let go and said, I'm not going to try and work out what this all means, I'm just going to go with it. You know, you could have been watching an act from the 1930s.
Yeah, and that's where this comes in, because in Jeeves and Wooster novels, I'm very conscious that they often talk about Pat and Mike, which is a double act, which is two people kind of banging each other on the head with umbrellas and that sort of thing. Does this come out of music, or is this where this...
Oh, totally, yeah, yeah.
And it's the idea of just two people not quite getting on and
yes,
prodding and poking.
You'd have the sort of patter merchant who'd come out and be the straight man role. Yeah. You'd say, oh, I'm going to sing a song, or, you know, try and do a bit, and then you'd get the sort of clown who would subvert the whole thing.
Is it old-fashioned?
So we've wandered from... I didn't finish mentioning the double acts.
Go on, the next moment we're getting more double acts. Lee and Herring.
Lee and Herring.
Stuart Lee started
French
as a double
act. French and Saunders. Yeah. Armstrong and Miller. I mean, you could say that Matt Lucas and David Williams were a double act of sorts, although they'd never sort of... I think to be a pure double act... Which is why perhaps some of those you would question, you have to sort of go out as we are ourselves, whether it's Vic and Bob, Laurel and Hardy, Morecambe and Wise, and a lot of those acts didn't. Although they worked together, they were mostly doing sketches and being other people. But even in Mitchell and Webb, there were bits in the show where they were supposedly themselves.
And they were both writing and performing.
Yes, they were.
Does that matter? Because it's like, I don't know if this feel, when you say Morecambe and Wise didn't write their own material,
well, that was the big change in the 80s. I mean, that's really what alternative comedy was about. It was, people were going to write their own act. It wasn't just someone would write them a load of gags and they'd do it. It was personal.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, pretty much all the good comedy since then. I mean, it's obviously something that sitcoms like Blackadder are different, but sketch-type comedy tends to now be written by the people who are in it.
It must be quite strange, I think, if you've created a character, say, Alan Partridge, so Steve Coogan and Steve Coogan and Armando Iannucci. Stephen Coogan. So they created this character, and now I think they're still writing, but with the Gibbons brothers. And so It must be quite strange to create a character and then allow someone else to continue to create him or change him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he originally was writing it with Armando Iannucci and Patrick Marber. And when they both went on to do other things, I was reading the interview with Steve the other day where he sort of said he actually felt a little bit bereft that they deserted him, which is a bit disingenuous because actually he buggered off to Hollywood and tried to become a big film star.
Not entirely
like
unsuccessfully.
Well, he did well.
He
did well. Who?
Coogan.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he didn't actually become a massive film star.
No,
he's done some great films, and he's brilliant in Stan and Ollie.
Is it a good film?
It is a good film.
Yeah.
And he's very good in it. He's actually quite moving in it, which I've not seen him do before, really. But Partridge is always there, really, because Steve Coogan is Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
And I think he would probably admit that. But he lucked upon finding these two twin brothers who started writing the books for him and stuff.
Their dynamic must be incredible to watch. I think.
Yeah, that's a weird
if you're
one,
if you know if you're friends, that's one thing. But as twin brothers, you have this.
And so are they sort of ventriloquizing Coogan then now?
Yeah. Totally. I mean, they wrote those sort of big sort of autobiographical Coogan books, and then worked with him on all the Sky stuff. And so now he's come roaring back, being able to do this show because he's got those two to do all the hard work for him.
we have a guy writing for the paper, Jonathan Lynn, who wrote Yes Minister.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I've met him a couple of times, and he talks about his friendship with, I've suddenly gone blank who the other person who wrote Yes Minister is. It's Jonathan Lynn.
I should know.
Yeah, I'm gonna look it up in a minute. But he's very left wing, and the guy who the other person who wrote it was very right wing. And there was a kind of a trade-off as they were doing this. And for a political comedy, that kind of worked. Each one was bringing something the other one didn't have. And I was kind of taken by that.
So that every dollar is what you've got to have. And particularly for a political thing like that. But, you know, if it had...
Anthony Jay. Jonathan Lynn and Anthony Jay. Yeah.
You know, if it had been pushing a political agenda, that show would have not been nearly as...
And it's a great
successful.
It's a great show.
Yeah,
I think
but it is about the civil servants who are always there, whatever government is in.
Yep.
It's the same guys who actually work the system, and you know it was a fantastically well written show.
Just to go back to one question that Thea raised, that have any of your characters that you've written for the Fast Show then other people written them? Did that how it worked with the Fast Show that you might invent them? Did you ever see someone else put the lines in their mouth?
Well, some of them were co-written. I mean, Swiss Tony, I used to co-write. Certainly when we were doing the sketch show, I used to co-write that with Bob Mortimer, because despite the fact that he comes across as a lovely, avuncular fellow on his fishing program with Paul, he's actually a filthy little man. and so he was very good at writing the rude stuff for Swiss Tony. And we did a sitcom where, you know, I had a team of writers. I mean, I was always co-writing, but... Yeah, I mean, any help I can get, I'll take.
And you were fine with that? People got the... And once people get the character and get the voice, you can think they can do it.
Yeah, because ultimately it's me that is performing it. I have the final control over it all.
Yeah.
So I don't think I could do a Swiss Tony that was entirely written by someone else.
No, you have to have it.
I was writing it with them.
Come on, we're going to get to the point. Where are the great double acts of today, your piece says? There is one pair who in many ways fill the shoes of Eric and Ernie.
In many ways, they do. Not in every way. Yeah. I don't think...
Thea was slightly appalled at this, I thought.
But only as you pointed out, because I do not watch. So I'm not familiar. I'm not familiar with their oeuvre.
Enough.
There you are. You see, so you can't make a judgment.
Exactly. So
I mean, they are not as...
We're about to get to it. Go on, let's see who it is.
You know, they are not as funny as Morecambe and Wise.
Yep.
But, as I say, they fulfil the same role.
And it is...
The tension will be killing
it
everyone.
It is killing me,
sure.
And I know who it is.
What?
Anton Deck.
Oh, haven't actually said the name.
Oh, you didn't say who it was.
It's Anton Deck.
Oh, sorry, yes,
Anton Deck.
Well, you see, they are the only double act now around, as far as that I can think of, that comes to mind. They are massively popular.
Yeah.
They have big Saturday night shows of various natures.
Yeah.
they go out as themselves, as Ant and Dec. I mean, obviously they're versions of themselves. Yeah. And they have that shtick where they, you know, they play off each other. They're very warm. They're very family friendly. So on all those levels, they are like Malcolm
and
White.
And I'll center there. They do do comedy.
They do comedy.
I mean, because you might think if you've just seen some of the sort of talent shows that they've hosted, which is fairly straight up and down presenting, but actually an awful lot of things. And one of the reasons why I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of It is so successful, it was said, was because they do gags, really.
So do they have sketches within...
In Saturday Night...
In some of the Saturday Night Live things, Saturday shows.
Saturday Night Takeaway.
And things like that, they will do sort of sketch type things, but they're best... as themselves, just playing off each other.
And are they funny enough, do you think, to take the...
Well, as I say, in many ways they're like... they are not as funny as Malcolm West. Because they don't have an Eddie Braben to be writing fantastic material for them, and because most of what they do is very ephemeral.
Yeah.
They're better at being themselves rather than doing the sketches, so they haven't done any great classic sketches that are constantly going to be repeated at Christmas.
But you are right, because we've got a picture at the in your piece, which is sort of Laurel and Hardy, Morecambe and Wise, Fry and Laurie. And they are really the only two that you could see, and the people know automatically who they are. They stand in the same relationship the whole time, don't they?
Yeah, but because, you know, I mean, we don't really make that kind of show anymore. Mm. We don't make sketch shows. We certainly don't make the sort of shows that had their heyday in the 70s, which were the sort of, well, like the Malcolm and Wise show, where there'd be music and dancing, and then there'd be some sketches, and there'd be some
so the
comedy that's on now tends to be obviously panel shows, but on some of those you'll get a sort of a double act dynamic, like on Would I Lie to You, the relationship between Lee Mack and David Mitchell is a sort of a double act.
So the principle, you think, gets attenuated and moved around, but ultimately it pops up in wherever.
I think people love to see that thing where one person is bouncing off someone else.
I think that's right. Charlie Higson, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Since Anthony Burgess's centenary in 2017, Manchester University Press has been busy revising and publishing the work of this local lad done good. No small feat given the extent of his exploits. After publishing his first novel at the age of 39, the self-described Grapherman was, it seems, never once idle. By the time he died in 1993, there were 33 works of fiction, including numerous scripts accepted or aborted for film and television, several translations, including the sonnets of the great blasphemous 19th century Roman poet Giuseppe Gioacchino Belli, libretti, plays, short stories, a couple of children's books, and a great deal of reviews, essays and talks. The latest instalments in the Irwell imprint, a nice nod there to the author's wish that his complete works be published in an Irwell edition named for the muddy and gravelient local river, have now arrived, and Margaret Drabble joins us in the studio to tell us what, why and how they are. Hello, Margaret.
Hello.
So we have four rather different works here to consider, three fictional works and one critical, a talk. So let's approach chronologically. Tell us about Puma, published in 1975.
This is a science fiction work about an asteroid coming to engulf and seize the Earth. And it was going to be made into a catastrophe movie, which never got made, but was published as part of a series of science fiction novels, which I haven't read. But this was meant to be standing on its own. And the text has now been rescued and published as a science fiction novel just by itself. And it's a very good read.
Is it good?
It's a really good read. I mean, it's not my thing at all. And frankly, if the TLS hadn't made me read it, I wouldn't have bothered. But I got into it because it's got a lot of vigour and sort of verbal play and good characters. And I really enjoyed it.
There's a detail you mention of asteroids being described as vermin of the sky, which I thought was particularly good.
That's wonderful. That's in a footnote. I mean, there are some excellent footnotes in this edition because people have had such fun editing Burgess because he was such a know-all. And so looking at what he discovered and putting a footnote on it is fun. And that was a proper astronomer, I think an Austrian astronomer, who called him the vermin of the sky. And I just love this. But this is a huge cat of the sky, cat for catastrophe. And I just love that sort of idea of it devouring us. Mm. Very good.
And he's a... I mean, the thing about Burgess is, at one level, he is a very literary figure because he, you know, man of letters, writes reviews, know-it-all.
Yeah.
But he was happy churning it out. I mean, he was a hack writer. I mean, so is this an example of a sort of him putting on the genre cloak and doing a bit of genre?
It was him going off to Hollywood and making money. I mean, he wrote some very funny bits of fiction about Hollywood, but he actually rather loved it, I had a feeling. He liked the money. He never earned enough from serious fiction. So he was happy to go off and write films that never got made.
He never made enough money from serious fiction?
No. The only serious novel that brought him money was Clockwork Orange.
Which he didn't think that was serious, really.
No, exactly. And it was also probably through the movie that it sold so well. So, yeah. No, he wanted to write sort of James Joyce-style books, which never sold very well. And as we know, Joyce was supported by his brother most of his life.
Yeah.
And I think Burgess just was a decent man. He wanted to earn his living for his wife and then his other wife. And so he worked at whatever came his way. He was a hack.
He was a hack, yeah. Well, he was reviewing at one point. He was just reviewing everything, wasn't he? He reviewed his own book, didn't he, for the Yorkshire Post?
Very naughtily reviewed his own book.
Was that a joke? That wasn't a sort of postmodern gag. That was a kind of...
I think it was to trick the editor who shouldn't have sent it to him. I think it was a sort of double joke, I think. But he was, according to Blake Morrison, he was a very good and conscientious reviewer and always turned in his copy on time.
God bless him.
And
rare breed.
Yeah. Would take on almost anything. I mean, he was a good hack.
Because John Updike was kind of the same, wasn't he? Martin Amis writes about him. He would review the latest Fiat Pinto. If you told John Updike to go and do something, he would just churn it out and come back. There's obviously a connection between sort of volubility and then never running dry.
And wanting to be working all the time.
Yeah, which you don't always associate with. Maybe you do with novelists. I mean, you're a novelist. The idea that you've got to earn your keep, you've got to put the shift in, and it's a long days and efforts.
Yeah, I always like to have something on the go. But I think Burgess was an alcoholic, and I think, well, he was a very, very heavy drinker. And I think it was his way of warding it off, like some other writers we could name. It was a way of keeping yourself sane and employed, even while drinking quite a lot.
Ben Masters, a couple of years ago, I think it was 2012, it must have been, the 50th anniversary of A Clockwork Orange, he said that Burgess had an inherent distaste for the popular. Do you think that's fair?
A distaste for the popular?
Just because I'm just thinking about, you know, how he would go off, he wanted to go off and make his fortune in Hollywood, and he kind of must have loved that idea of mass media, in a sense.
He loved the mass media, but not in the novel. I think he kind of divided himself up into the serious writer, like James Joyce, and the person who could write a screenplay and please the masses. I think the evidence is that he was upset by Kubrick's success with The Clockwork Orange, that he was made anxious by its great success and by the violence that it unleashed, or allegedly unleashed. So I think there were two parts of him. He wrote a book before Clockwork Orange, which I read for the purpose of this exercise, called Honey for the Bears, which is set in Russia, in which you see a lot of the original ideas of Clockwork Orange, but in a kind of almost sort of autobiographical format. So you see, it all comes from somewhere, but that book didn't sell so well. But then Clockwork Orange sort of hit the mainstream.
And he resented that. I mean, I've seen quotes of him where he said, you know, because I think if he wanted to be remembered, he wouldn't have wanted to be remembered by A Clockwork Orange.
And that's the only as a minor novel.
Well, it is a minor novel. And it really is Kubrick's fame, perhaps you could say, rather than his, that means most to us.
Yeah. One of the next books you look at is the brilliant title, which sounds odd to the ears of TLS people, Beards, Roman Women.
Such a ludicrous title.
I just can't believe that, yeah.
I can't believe they chose it. He wanted it to be called Rome in the Rain.
That's quite
which
nice.
Which is a much nicer title. And the novel really was inspired by a series of photographs of Rome in the Rain. Basically, they're all very watery photographs. And the photographer, whose name I forget, was trying to find a writer to do a travelogue. But Burgess came up with this idea of writing a novel to go with these images, which are all very nicely reproduced in the Irwell edition.
And what, is it a good book?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a confessional book about his first marriage and his second marriage, and everybody behaves very badly, but they're quite intense and passionate.
Well, it sounds like the characters have more flesh and blood on them than perhaps in Puma.
Oh yes, much more. I mean, in Puma they're sort of exaggerated stereotypes. But in Beard's Roman Women, it is really a terrible title. They're more kind of, well, they're real. I mean, uh-huh. It is his first wife and his second wife. Liana, the second wife, who's the Roman photographer, very much of the sort of Dolce Vita period, and the first wife who died of alcohol.
And in fact, his first wife was called Lynn, so there's some play going on there.
Yes, absolutely.
I just can't believe that title now I think about it.
How did the Americans apparently insisted on it? You see, the footnotes are so useful in this edition, because it's not a very serious point, but it's interesting to know that it was the US that chose that title.
Well, I think in some ways there is a kind of serious point, because it didn't sell, presumably.
I don't think so.
Because, I mean,
no.
I'd never heard...
I'd never heard of it.
Well, if you've never heard of it...
I'd never heard of it. And in fact, when I was asked to review it, I thought it was by Mary Beard. I mean, I thought they've obviously stuck a little package of books together. Yeah. She has commented on Burgess, but nothing of the sort. The narrator in this novel is called Mr. Beard, which is the reason why. But he's only got two Roman women, and one's his wife, so it doesn't seem very meaningful.
Should we move on to the next one, which isn't really by Burgess? It's kind of based on a script of his, The Black Prince, which Adam Roberts has turned into a novel, is that right?
That's right, yes. A historical novel.
This is good, bad, indifferent?
It's good. I mean, I don't think I would have read it had I not been asked to do so.
You've only read stuff you've been paid to do, him, and not very much either, Margaret, to do it. So it's very decent of you to... I always think that's the real test. I often think that would I carry on with this if it wasn't my job?
But
is a fairly good test of whether a book's worth it.
Well, in this case, it was worth it. Because I would never have picked it up voluntarily, because I'm not very good on historical fiction.
Oh, do you not like it?
Well, not really, no. And this is extremely violent.
Well, it's set during the 100 Years' War. Is that right?
It's set during the 100 Years' War, and it's the Black Prince himself, and the battles of Crecy and Agincourt. Not Agincourt, we don't get that far. But it's all about Aquitaine and Poitiers, and it's of horrific violence.
I love historical fiction, Margaret. Would I like this?
You probably would. It's told in a very... I won't say postmodern, because it's more Theodore Dreiser. It's sort of it's got sort of headlines from newsreel and camera angles, but the historical stuff is really good, and you can tell that Adam Roberts has done a lot of work on medieval warfare, and it's horrible.
So it's an homage, but it stands up on its own. It doesn't sort of need to be next to Burgess for...
No, not at all. It stands up by itself. And I was very interested that this was published by crowdfunding.
Mm.
And it's perfectly serious
Unbound.
Book. And has been published by crowdfunding. And I thought, well, that's really good, that this perfectly serious work, which obviously involved a lot of work, a lot of research, a lot of reading, found enough people to believe in it and to appear in a rather handsome edition. I think that's excellent.
Does it feel bad? Jessian, does it feel like it comes somehow from the imagination of Burgess?
In a way it does. There's this very scatological element. There's an awful lot about diseases of the bowel and the plague and this, that and the other. But there's also some very good jokes. I liked very much about the joke, if I can remember it, about how they recognise the name of Julius Caesar, because he really was a Caesar. He seized other people's lands. And that is just a very funny joke on
is
the
it?
Page.
Yeah.
And Burgess did that on nearly every page. He punned outrageously.
Well, I love a pun.
Yeah, I quite like a pun.
You can't, I love it too much, Theo. People would arguably say it the TLS, possibly. I love a pun
not
headline.
Me.
Yes, well, so do I.
Yeah. What was he like as a critic? We have one of his talks here, Obscenity in the Arts. It started as a talk.
Frankly, it was a bit of self-defence. It was an apologia, because he delivered this in Malta, where he'd gone with his wife, his second wife, as a tax evader. Not very successful. He wasn't very good at anything practical, and he kept getting into trouble, and he got into trouble with the censorship. I mean, he was a born Catholic, but he wasn't a practising Catholic, but Malta was very Catholic, and the censorship was very heavy, and he was always getting into trouble. So he thought he'd deliver this lecture and say what obscenity was and why it did or didn't matter.
And when he was in Malta, censorship took on a very specific role in his life, because all of the books that many of the books that he was being sent to review got stuck in the postal service. They weren't allowed through to him. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, he hadn't foreseen this at all. But and I mean, the most surprising books got stuck in the in the system. People took against the title, they took against the book jacket, and they didn't arrive. So he had difficulties with the people he was supposed to be working for.
Was his verdict on obscenity and censorship anything surprising, or was it just obscenity's okay and censorship is bad?
Obscenity's okay, pornography's okay if it's written to just please. I don't think any of them foresaw the violence that was coming our way with the internet and the total deregularisation of content. Yeah. And so he was in favour of books being published, whatever they were like. And there's some interesting stuff in that talk, which he did brush up, I think, for publication, about Pamela Hansford-Johnson, Pamela Snow, who wrote about the Moore's murders. And he was very annoyed with her at the time because they were friends, but she had named him as somebody who was too deregulatory. And I always thought that she had a point, because if your library is full of very violent matter and then you go and violently kill people, it's just possible there's some connection with your reading habits, you know. So all that argument is put in his talk, which he delivered to the good people of Malta. And then I think later in his life he slightly changed his mind.
Yeah, so the Malta talk, was that in the mid-70s?
It was the 70s. It was at the very height of permissiveness, really.
Right, and so then you mentioned towards the end of your piece that by 1993, which is shortly before he died, he did revise his opinions.
According to Blake, he was retracting his views. But, I mean, I have no first-hand evidence of that. But I think he probably was.
There's an argument that we talked about Clockwork Orange being regarded as a minor work by him. What do you think should be regarded as his major works? What sort of writer? We've talked about him as a hack, which he clearly was, but he was also very literary. What would he be content with being remembered for, and what do you think he should be remembered for? Is it the same thing?
I think he would be content to be remembered for Earthly Powers, which is a late great novel.
It is a great novel.
It's a huge novel.
It is a huge novel.
But it's full of material.
And it's basically one of those, I love these novels, which are where real life figures pop up, so Hemingway's in it and things like that.
So he didn't particularly like, did he? He wasn't very kind about Hemingway. He didn't like his style. It was kind of, it was anathema to him, I suppose,
it was the reverse style.
Kind of opposite.
He's the opposite. He's verbose. I mean, he's a Joycean, though he didn't always like being called a Joycean, but that he was on that side of the divide.
But I think Earthly Powers has that benefit of being the readable like a genre novel, but having slightly more literary aspiration. So it's kind of in that sort of sweet spot between the two.
It's a historical novel in a sense, but it's also covering lots of time that I knew. I personally lived it, so I recognise real people in there.
Really?
And, I mean, there are real people that one might have known and did know. So it has a many-layered reality. The only thing that annoyed me was the way he called James Joyce Jimmy, which I know that James Joyce's wife Nora called him Jimmy, but I don't think other people did. I just have a sense that he was presuming a bit.
It's got a very famous first sentence, which I was just trying to remember, but it is: it was the afternoon of my 81st birthday, and I was in bed with my catamite when Ali announced that the Archbishop had come to see me.
It's brilliant.
Which is arguably one of the great first lines in all of literature.
It is a great, great line, and it puts all the themes of the book in one sentence.
Yeah, you know exactly what's going on.
And you've got to read on. It's very, very good. No.
And he will be remembered. I mean, 100 years' time, people will be reading Anthony.
Well, probably still be publishing him.
They'll probably still be getting through the first edition of the reprint. Yeah. I mean, that book, Earthly Powers, if they do footnote it all, the footnotes will be as long as the book, because it is really so packed with... Do we still call it intertextuality?
Yeah,
I don't know if we do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's packed with that. And it'd be such fun just to unravel every single reference and quote.
Yeah, it's been lovely talking to you about it, Margaret Drabble. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Margaret Drabble and to Charlie Higson. This week's paper is full of other good stuff, including a huge profile of Gandhi, who, like Churchill, suffers from people trying to make him out to be either solely a hero or solely a villain. Next week, Thea, we've just established, is going to call in.
Yep, me and Alf.
And your dog. But Lucy and I will be here doing the real work, not from home, actual work.
Well, I don't know. It remains to be seen what kind of work I will be doing. No. I suspect there'll be a lot of cleaning and scrubbing.
That's why you're calling in. We're going to find out. And we're going to probably be talking about chimpanzees.
As we do.
As we do. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.